Splish Splash, in honor of Aquaman, what's your favorite nautical movie until you saw Aquaman?
I'm Giddy Rich, and my real answer is Titanic, but I want to use the space to promote Finest Hours with Chris Pine and Ben Foster and Casey Affleck. They got to get over the bar. It's great. No one saw it.
I am Matt Patches, and I was going to say Castaway because I just like when he's floating around with Wilson. But now, what's that Robert Redford movie where he's all alone on
All is lost.
Is all lost?
Ben back?
Q&A question. I'm going with All is Lost.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm also going with Titanic, and I will also profane that holy film by jokingly mentioning another, or not so jokingly, I don't know, I guess Katie liked their finest, but I'll go with, not their finest, what the fuck am I talking about, Katie?
Finest hours.
Their finest hours. I had too much moonshine. I'll shout out to Sphere, which is a bad movie that I watch all the time when it's on TV.
On Ambien.
But Sphere, it's probably on TV right now if you got cable. Go watch Sphere. I love sci-fi movies, like increasingly ominous sci-fi movies that have title cards like along the way that it's like The Storm, and then it's like a 10 ominous minutes, and it's like The Sphere, and then it's like another 10 ominous minutes. I love it. Queen Latifah gets killed by jellyfish. It's crazy.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 243, and it's the week of Wednesday, December 19th. Happy almost Christmas, everybody. On that day, in 1843, Charles Dickens published A Christmas Carol. He really wasn't taking advantage of the full Christmas season back then.
Remember, they made a whole movie about this, like last year, with Dan Stevens.
Did, didn't they?
I saw it.
Hey. Yeah.
In one ear and out the other.
Was Christopher Plummer also in that one?
Sure.
Yes. He was Scrooge-ish.
Wow. They sure did make that whole movie.
Have you ever read The Christmas Carol? Have you ever read the Dickens?
I don't think I original? Have.
I was thinking about this. I feel like I owe it to myself to read that eventually.
I watched a Looney Tunes version of A Christmas Carol that's available on Hulu right now.
My other question about The Christmas Carol is what Republicans think about it.
I don't know.
Because do they think it's good? If you're listening and you have a thought, please leave it in our iTunes reviews. Segue.
Yeah, speaking of which, I hear we have some iTunes reviews that aren't about that question yet, but they're about other things.
Yeah, we got iTunes reviews. Raz Balam says, fun times, 5 stars. Easily my new favorite podcast right now. It's fun to finally hear a lot of my own sentiments on film and other forms of media being reflected by people I admire greatly. David's 25 Best Films Countdown was amazing, and it inspired me to make one of my own this January. Oh, thanks. I look forward to watching that. However, before you guys officially consider the year over, I'd recommend you watch the film Border by Ali Abbasi. Parentheses, editor's note from me, David, the film that I missed this year that I keep kicking myself for. I'm sure I would have loved it. It missed the Oscar shortlist today, which feels like a bummer even though I haven't seen it. My boss, Eric Cohn, loves this movie. I should check it out. Anyway, it's an incredibly unique and captivating take on Norwegian mythology and has to be my favorite example of a modern fairy tale in recent years. Watch it. Seriously. You won't regret it. Was this review helpful? Yes. To me and anyone else who knows that they need to catch up with Border. Penguin Tom says, a cross-promotional Game of Daves. I've been inspired this week to finally leave reviews for my two favorite podcasts, both of which are produced by Dave Gonzalez. Both Fighting in the War Room and A Storm of Spoilers tend to drop on the same day every week in my podcatcher of choice, which seems to download episodes with little regard to when they were recorded and or uploaded. It sounds like you need a new podcatcher, Penguin Tom. So, well, a fun game. Yeah, that too. Why is he dropping podcasts on the same day? That just seems bad for business. Anyway, so a fun game I like to play every week is to try to figure out which episode was recorded first, based on the references to the same material dropped by Dave in both podcasts. This week, Dave offered a smorgasbord of Into the Spider-Verse-related CGI jargon in both episodes. About animation styles, 3D may be a step too far, comic book style color bleeding, and Benday dots. I didn't understand a single word of it, but it was my favorite episode of A Game of Dave's yet. 5 stars. how Dave can try to figure out which of these reviews I wrote first. Now Dave can try to figure out which of these reviews I wrote first. Was this helpful? Yes, there was a clue to figure out which of these two reviews. I assume there's another one on the Storm of Spoilers feed that Dave wrote first. The Storm of Spoilers better shout us out. I feel like that would do a lot more good for us than us shouting out Storm of Spoilers would do for them. Anyway.
Well, Dave is sick, so he's not here right now to hear this clue.
I know. Hopefully he'll weigh in on if he figured out the mystery. Keep leaving us reviews. We are going to be not recording new episodes for a little while. Our top tens are coming up, but we'll have lots to catch up on in the new year.
Aquaman. That's right. In our tidbit, we're talking about Aquaman and beyond. Aquaman is out in theaters, coming out this week after, I feel like it actually screened early for Amazon Prime members. I feel like these movies, all these December movies have just come out willy-nilly.
Like whenever they want. It's like, yeah, it's playing now. Why not?
Yeah, Spider-Verse
came out for 1 weekend.
Well, the embargoes
keep lifting in weird ways. Like, yeah. Aquaman embargo was up weeks ago.
Yeah, so it's tough to tell when these movies are out, but I'm pretty sure it's coming out this weekend. People are going to get to ride the wave of Aquaman. Will it be good? I think it's superb, actually. I really was surprised that after all these DC movies aping the Avengers and Marvel and aping Nolan and trying to figure out how to franchise all this stuff and intertwine stories and characters, here's a really refreshing movie that technically is a sequel to Justice League. I believe the events of Justice League are mentioned. I'm trying to remember the meaningless CG bad guy from Justice League, and I dunked on him so often.
It's a Shakespearean name. No, it's a Shakespearean name.
Doomsday?
It's like, it's fuck.
Played by Kieran Hines.
No. Oh, this is going to bother. It's going to.
He's big. He's.
It's like something to do with the theater world. I can see it in my head.
Steppenwolf. How could we forget Steppenwolf? We are bad DC movie fans here.
That has been well established.
Steppenwolf gets a little name check in Aquaman, but other than that, it's really divorced from everything that's happened in the DC universe, even the things that have worked, like Wonder Woman. This is pure. This is directed by James Wan, written by a ton of people, but I'm sure James Wan had everything to do with injecting his own personality into this script based on the fact that it just seems like an expression of someone who is obsessed with action figures and cartoons and Saturday morning extravaganzas. This is pure comic book in a way that all these comic book movies struggle to actually to be that, to be page turning fun, to be bursts of color with splash pages, no pun intended, with Aquaman. This is very silly and very extravagant and really expensive looking. I gotta say, like, I'm always disappointed by Marvel movies in terms of their scope. We've talked about it on this podcast over and over and over again. I thought Avengers Infinity War was kind of like minuscule. I never thought it reached the epic scope of its marketing. But Aquaman certainly does. This is like Lord of the Rings size battles and lots of locations and tons of CGI doing the work of underwater battles, plus doing the work of like backdrops, Baz Luhrmann's Australia style. The whole thing seems like shot on green screens.
I thought this was a documentary told in real time.
It's cinema verite following an actual Atlantean. No, it is not. This is really, really, really silly, but we want to open up this conversation a bit because I think I'm the only one who's seen Aquaman, but I hope I'm enticing all of you to see this movie because
this, by all of you, you mean Katie and I feel like you're not.
Yes. Right. I'm not.
Are you not going to see it at all, David?
No, God, no.
I'm not the only one raving about Aquaman.
Let
it be known.
There is only one kind of movie that I will see if I don't have to see it for work. And that's a movie that my wife wants to see. And I don't think that Aquaman falls under that.
But
category.
Here's the thing, David. Here's the thing. 2018 is a different sort of year, even though we are 10 years into the Marvel moviedom. The world, the landscape has been reshaped. It's all superheroes all the time. We're all kind of sick of them, even though some of us love them. But this year is different from Black Panther to Avengers Infinity War, it's one of the only movies that like everybody on the planet saw, even if you didn't like it that much. It was an event when we so often don't have those. And then you have Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, a movie that you admit you love, and it might be changing your mind about superhero movies. So like, what is the deal with superhero cinema? It's something that's supposed to have run out of steam.
It's funny because for a while now, as someone who, you know, anyone who listens to this podcast for any amount of time is sick of hearing me talk about superhero movies and how much I tend to dislike them. And yet, for several years now, every time I sit down to review one of them, it kind of feels like, well, you know, I don't really like superhero movies, but this one has a few interesting things going on. And that's not always the case, and certainly with the DC movies, it hasn't been. But, you know, the Marvel movies have been going in increasingly interesting directions, and Black Panther had a lot of obvious value to it, and I even thought that leaning harder into specific genres and way a little bit away from the usual Marvel template really helped something like Spider-Man Homecoming, and having Taika Waititi make a Taika Waititi movie or something close to it anyway, was good for Thor Ragnarok. But what's interesting about the ubiquity of Infinity War is that it feels like the death rattle of a certain kind of superhero movie, maybe. I mean, this is a naive and optimistic view that the empty spectacle that a lot of these movies represent, where it's just characters standing around speechifying about, like, pop civil debates, and just, you know, no emotion, no real consequences, because snap your fingers here and someone disappears there and then they come back. I think it was far and away the worst superhero film of the year, one of the worst superhero films I've ever seen, and I'm dreading the sequel, but it was in the middle of a year that felt like a real resurgence for the superhero genre, and actually for the first time has me, if not excited or optimistic necessarily, if that'd be putting it strongly.
I believe hype, like, is the word. You're hyped.
Yeah, it has me hashtag hyped. No, it has me curious at the very least for where things are going from here. I mean, I'm not ever going to be happy about the ubiquity of this genre when it comes at the expense of so many other kinds of movies, but if we do have to deal with them every week, something as truly, you know, something that has the value that Black Panther does, that is as groundbreaking, Black Panther is groundbreaking in its own way, of course, but Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse feels like one of the only movies, I don't think any of the Marvel movies, Black Panther included, by the time it came around, felt like a gamble in a way. Felt like they were really taking a risk. Spider-Verse is a bold piece of filmmaking that takes a lot of chances, that is actually takes stock of how far we've come in the superhero world. It's really about, in a metatextual way, the value of these stories, the power of origin stories, also the repetitiveness of origin stories. It works into its text in a really, really funny way. Aquaman sounds like a lot,
To what you're speaking to, I mean, I do think the big difference between Aquaman and a lot of, you know, like a Deadpool 2 even, or an Infinity War, is I feel like it has a stamp on it at a time. I feel like in the last 5 years, especially, we got so many movies that felt like they were being made by the previz teams, right? Like, we're going to direct the action.
Why Lucretia Martel said she wouldn't make a Marvel movie.
That was hilarious, by the way. That speaks so, I mean, that's such truth, right? They have these teams in-house at Marvel Studios. They're already directing the action scenes when a director comes on, where they want to fill in the blanks. But in Taika Waititi's case, there was not a lot of action at Thor Ragnarok, so that's how I think that movie feels like a Taika Waititi movie.
And when
I think
the action Ryan starts, Coogler, my interest just faded.
Right. And Black Panther kind of suffers the same thing, in my opinion.
Ever.
Yeah. But there's a lot of Ryan Coogler in that movie, too. And I wonder if in post-Avengers Endgame, if we'll see more directors need to kind of step up and actually make their own movies as audiences demand for diversity or demand for personality and representation. These movies, you need directors who can bring that, and you have to get away from previz in a way. And Aquaman, I mean, it seems ridiculous, but here James Wan has been stumping hard for this movie and talking about how it's about a mixed race person, and it means a lot to him, and he wants to like bring his entire personality into this movie, and it seems very expressive. I mean, I think it's up there. It's not with the craft of Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight movies, but it's certainly the control of that. There's very few people who get to make a movie that costs $200 million or something and actually get what they want to do. They're like the Wachowskis, Spielberg, Nolan. And I think James Wan actually got to do that in Aquaman. And I'm hoping that's a trend in these movies. Sorry, Katie. What?
Look, sorry, I was yawning. I wanted to ask you. So, given that Aquaman, you're saying, has this personality, like, I was going to say, like, of course, Marvel isn't going to try to, like, give directors more power. They've built this entire giant empire on giving directors no power. But do you feel like Aquaman is positioned to become a hit and be like, okay, we need some creativity in this? Like, Wonder Woman, for all the credit that Patty Jenkins got for bringing a lot to it, like, it did not feel like a director's movie. So, I'm not sure that Marvel is going to feel the pressure yet.
Well, I think. I hope that Patty Jenkins' success actually gives her more cred. I mean, the big problem with Wonder Woman is that third act that feels like a clunky Zack Snyder movie in the end, and I think it took a lot of hits for that, and you would want more of what made Wonder Woman soar so high, the first two acts, the character stuff, the, like, character-driven action. That seems more of what Patty Jenkins is bringing to that movie. And based on how DC is pivoting in the aftermath of the Snyderverse, I mean, maybe we'll get the Snyder cut of Justice League. That could be a huge game changer,
into
obviously.
Into the Snyderverse?
Yes,
yeah, into also, the Snyderverse. I fear that... I mean, I remember when Homecoming came out, I sort of diagnosed that as the future, the hopeful future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and that they would like, because I liked that movie when it was leaning into the John Hughes-ness of it all and really being about a high school movie that was inflected with these superhero elements. And I saw a future for Marvel where they could really lean hard into genre and have the superhero trappings just on the outside of it by binding these movies together in a coherent cinematic universe. But my fear, and obviously that movie made a ton of money. I don't think anyone at Marvel was disappointed. But my fear is that the same disease that led us down to the blockbuster or bust kind of filmmaking, where every movie, it's not like studios aren't interested in making movies that only make $30 or $40 million. I mean, they want to make movies that make billions with a B.
But
and if you make smaller Marvel movies that are riskier, that take chances, the opportunity to do that is going, the movies might be better, but the opportunity to do that is going to shrink. And you have something like Spider-Verse, which is going to turn out to be a huge hit, but you know, and maybe the audience will get more acclimated to animated superhero movies, and the first weekend will be stronger in the future with sequels. I don't know. But the $35 million that it pulled in domestic is obviously a fraction of what, you know, the next Infinity War is going to pull in its opening weekends. And I don't know if the studios are going to be as enthralled by that as we are.
I mean, while Marvel's next few movies are gigantic, they've got Captain Marvel and Endgame and the Spider-Man sequel. I think you're right about Marvel. I don't know if you're right about all the other competition trying to figure out how to compete with Marvel, and that kind of works to our benefit. I mean, I'm not necessarily pumped to see Todd Phillips' Joker, but I am ready to see someone who is a Martin Scorsese stan basically filter Joker through Taxi Driver and through Gritty New York. And
literally,
do that
the
thing.
Only way that I could be less excited about Todd Phillips' Joker is if it were Adam McKay's Joker. So,
the other movie that they have coming up, this Birds of Prey movie with directed by Kathy Yan. This is a Margot Robbie fueled project. This is like taking the scorched earth of Suicide Squad, taking the one good thing about it, and trying to realize what's good and make an entire movie out of that. And I have faith that maybe the competition will make the DC movies actually more creative. And I mean, all of these movies, even if they're by the book Marvel or DC, they're certainly making more of an impact than all the other blockbusters that are coming out. Like, this summer was a bummer. I think of Jurassic World 2 all the time, and just like, that's every other movie that's coming out. And that's why superhero cinema is here to stay, because it's still personality driven in a way that all these other clunky blockbusters. I mean, I'm even thinking of Bumblebee, this reboot that people seem to be gaga for. I'm like, this is a 12-year-old's movie. That's fine. It has no story. It is by the books. It has no action. I don't understand the infatuation with Bumblebee. I think it's because you get to go to Cybertron for like 5 minutes and everybody from the 80s is like flipping out. That's not enough for me. But I gotta say, superhero movies, they might be good.
'Cause I don't know what to say with you. Fill my head with shame, 'cause you need someone to blame. I'm just an object of disdain to you. I'm only 17, I don't know what you mean by my tongue. Now that's your.
Since this is the last episode we're recording for the rest of the year, there's a lot of new movies coming out that we just kind of want to catch up on briefly. And David is the only person who has seen what sounds like the most insane movie of the year or of this fall period. And I'm including Aquaman. David, what in God's name is going on with Welcome to Marwen?
Well, first of all, what's going on with Welcome to Marwen is that I have been singing to myself into the tune of Hairspray's Welcome to Baltimore or Good Morning Baltimore. Well, I've been singing Welcome to Marwen Call because Marwen Call is the name of the documentary about Mark Hogenkamp, who is was an illustrator living in upstate New York, who had a long history. Was in the Navy, and he was an alcoholic, and he also enjoyed dressing up, or not dressing up as a woman, but wearing high-heeled shoes and stockings. And it was not a sexual fetish. It's just like he explains in this movie that we're going to get to in this very short segment, something he did to enjoy the essence of women. He had a very, I don't know, he looked at women as in a different way. This is not a sexualized thing necessarily, but then after he got beat by some neo-Nazis, he knocked all the memories out of his head, and left him severely impaired. He could no longer draw, and there's a documentary about this called Marwen Call. He developed, a world for himself, a way of making something beautiful out of his pain and also sort of processing his trauma, a world of dolls that he built in his backyard. There were these, like, he created this World War II sort of fantasy where he was represented by a character called Hoagie, who was like a corporal in the army, whatever, and, kind of a Hogan's hero type. And he had all these various women who were his protectors, and the women sort of saved him. And and he took photographs of them. The photographs were startling and very lifelike, and they sort of caught the eye of somebody in the art world. And he, still living on hand to mouth. His whole story is a very damning critique of our healthcare system, because once his healthcare ran out, that was when he resorted to doing this as some sort of self-therapy, self-care. But anyway, that's Marwen Call, a documentary that is streaming somewhere. And now Robert Zemeckis saw that documentary on PBS one night, true story, and thought that has to be my next movie. Robert Zemeckis, who has now from Beowulf onwards, or the Polar Express onwards, had a long history of using motion capture to try to get closer and closer to reality, essentially, going deeper and deeper and deeper into the uncanny valley.
He'll never get out.
He'll never get to the bottom. He'll never get out. And with Mark Hogenkamp's story, he found a perfect vehicle, to his mind anyway, for the next thing to do. And so now, with Steve Carell's help, he has created a completely unclassifiable family, like traumatic, inspirational family story that uses a lot of motion capture CGI to bring to life the world that Mark Hogenkamp created with
the traumatic
dolls.
World.
Yeah.
Because the commercials are like Steve Carell and Steve Carell.
Yeah.
Welcome
yeah.
to Marwen.
The movie is like half motion capture dolls of like Janelle Monáe and Leslie Mann and Gwendolyn Christie and Robert Zemeckis' wife, as the women who are in his life and who are really taking care of him.
There was a time when this movie was being called The Women of Marwen, I remember.
Yeah, which would have made a certain amount of sense for sure.
Also, who is Robert Zemeckis' wife?
She's an actress who's appeared in a number of his films.
I'm going to look this up.
And half of the movie is about the on the real world level of Mark Hogenkamp struggling with his disability after he's been hurt and living with his trauma and trying to make something positive out of his pain and suffering from depression. And Leslie Mann moves in next door, or across the street from him rather, and she has an abusive ex. And of course, because this is a Robert Zemeckis movie and his music supervisor should be tried at the Hague, every time the ex rolls in, it plays like Cat Scratch Fever, shit like that. And it's totally maddening. But this movie is like such a crazy stir fry of different things. None of them really come together. It all feels like it's Diane Kruger plays, she never appears in the flesh, but She's been mocapped as the witch Deja Thoris, who essentially represents his depression and also maybe the pharmaceutical industry. And like,
shout out John Carter.
Yeah. And like keeps Mark Hogenkamp, sort of in his pain. And she has a hand that like rockets people through time. And there are other Robert Zemeckis signature, you know, iconography that pop up in this movie. I won't say any more than that. But it, you know, the same problem that I have with the documentary, which is that Mark Hogenkamp's art is the clearest, most lucid expression of his trauma, his pain, how he's synthesizing it into something new. And making a documentary about that adds a layer between where we are and what we're looking at. There's a distancing effect, and you can't really get to the heart of what he's doing. And then this movie is like a much more garish additional layer, where in trying to use this technology, it was short. I mean, this movie was, it struck my attention today, shortlisted for the Best Visual Effects Oscar. In trying to use this technology and the motion capture and all of that to really bring ostensibly Mark Hogenkamp's imagination, the world that he's created to life, only pushes it further away and makes it feel less rooted in a human experience and more as just an overcompensating spectacle to get closer to nothing in particular. The movie is weird as fuck. Its cinema score is going to be hilarious. I think Middle America is going to have a lot of fun with this. The movie is, contrary to some of the early controversy from the trailer, and early controversy based on trailer is 100% of the time bone dumb, just because you don't have enough information to work with. The movie is not coy about Mark's desire to dress up in, to wear heels, to and his thoughts about women and all that stuff. It's very, from the very beginning of the movie, very upfront about that. And I think audiences, especially audiences of some worldviews, will be challenged by that.
But David, no one's going to see this movie.
Right. So that's an issue. It could be, okay, so 95% chance this movie is a Titanic failure, although it only cost, according to Wikipedia, $39 million, which sounds crazy. It's like, I feel like either motion capture technology has just become dirt cheap, or I don't know. But everybody, including the animators, worked for like – everybody on the movie worked for scale.
They
the animators worked for free.
Robert Zemeckis' house already.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know. That number feels wrong. But it sounds like Universal has bigger problems with mortal engines. But there's a weird chance, because sometimes this happens in our dumb country, that – movies that seem extraordinarily, I don't know, destined to fail somehow blow up. And that wouldn't be the worst thing. Because this movie is strangely watchable, if only because you're just so in awe of what they're trying to cohere into a single studio film with like studio film trappings and all the rest, while it's clearly, you know, the math doesn't really add up. It doesn't fit into any sort of box the studio's operating. It's never a good sign, at least for a studio, when in the trailer for a major Hollywood studio's movie, they call something the most original movie of the year. That is not language that a major Hollywood studio wants to use to convey, to sell you on something. Original does not translate to money. Groundbreaking, if they have another Avatar movie, that's one thing. But original is code for, we have no idea what we just funded, and we have no idea how to sell it. So it's, definitely a curveball if you're looking for something different, but and want to see it in a multiplex.
Something different, like, there's so many.
I know, but if you're stuck in a multiplex because your whole family's gone on Christmas and you all went into different auditoriums, but they're not playing like Cold War or Shoplifters or whatever.
Or Aquaman.
They'll probably be playing Aquaman. Or Bumblebee, which I hear is not bad. Welcome to Marwin. I don't know. The Zemeckis heads out there. Knock yourselves out. I'm still trying to figure out what to make of it.
Stepped out of my zone. I had to get out of the loan and figure it out on my own. And I know what I really want now. Can't stop me, can't break it. But don't kill me, go make me. Shoot for the stars, don't save me. And now I see clearly HD.
Gotta go hard. Gotta go hard. I ain't got time to wait.
I ain't got.
Yeah.
Actually, as of this podcast, I think Mary Poppins comes out a little early. So this podcast is out, and so is Mary Poppins Returns. She has returned from the grave. She is back alive and breathing. Yeah, Zombie Poppins is here. Oh, so many years after the original came out in what, 1962? That sounds right. 1964, I think.
There you go.
And that's many more. I can't do math. 54 years later? Is that right? Jesus.
64. No, 54.
And it's an actual direct sequel. She has come back with her memories. She lives. And Katie, you thought this movie was charming as hell. It's a beautiful musical epic. Tell us why Mary Poppins Returns is incredible, because then the boys are going to be real downers about it, I think.
I don't know if I ever called it an incredible musical epic. I enjoyed this movie.
No, I think that was on the poster. And they
I don't want to spoil our top 10 episode, but this was your number one film of the year. So please.
It was number one, number two, and number three somehow.
Yeah, that's true. I just sang all the songs at you. Mm-hmm. No, I enjoyed this movie a lot. I had been watching the original Mary Poppins with my child Charlie for a while.
Humble.
I kind of had it set in the back of my mind for a little bit. I thought Mary Poppins Returns did a really good job of having a lot of the DNA of the original, probably to a certain extent too much. It's it feels like a product kind of engineered to be like, oh, well, here's the song that's like the Chimney Sweep song, and here's the sing that's like Stay Awake, and here's the sing. Well, that's actually not.
Did it remind you of The Force Awakens in that sense, and that it's sort of like a sequel slash soft remake?
Sort of. I don't think I had the Star Wars like DNA as burned as closely into my brain as that, but I'm sure that that is an apt comparison. And I mean, Disney has had no qualms about full on remaking or shot for shot remaking is with The Lion King, their old stuff. So I don't think they would take any of that as an insult. And I think it has enough newer things that it doesn't just feel like you're going over the same territory. You've got musical numbers that don't really have a close cognate in the original, like this early one where she puts the kids in the bath. That's sort of like Spoonful of Sugar, where they're all cleaning up their rooms, but it's on an undersea adventure. Obviously, the effects in this movie, the effects in the original 1964 film are mind-boggling to watch even now, and how they did it and the way that CGI works. It's not quite as impressive now, but there's some really gorgeous scenes. It's not all just kind of like throw everything at the wall CGI. Emily Blunt, I think, really pulls off a very difficult job of being Mary Poppins without being Julie Andrews. The character does feel different. She keeps a lot of the sternness that if you saw Saving Mr. Banks, that Disney hagiography that everyone loved and remembers. Something that was really important to Pale Travers is that Mary Poppins is kind of like a stone cold bitch. And she keeps that up while also being like delightful and beautiful and taking these kids on these magical adventures. I did not hate Lin-Manuel Miranda, although I don't think he's the best part of the movie by any means. It's weird that he's gotten so far as an actor who is not really that great an actor or a singer. But he's got a lot of charm.
He's lovable.
And he's a presence, you know? He's like, oi, the weather, the lights of London. I can't do a Cockney accent.
Smile with me.
Yeah,
you gotta look at the lovely London sky. Ben Whishaw, who our beloved Joanna Robinson would talk about forever, and David is well aware, is a very good bear, is really great as this heartbroken dad who's trying to keep his family together. There's an actual plot in this Mary Poppins, which isn't in the original, like, which really, it's about parents being kind of bad parents, and they figure out how to be good parents. There's kind of a caper element to this, where they're trying to find a piece of paper that'll solve everything, and you know, they tangle with the bad bank president who's played by Colin Firth, and you know it'll all turn out fine, but I think it kind of gives it some momentum drive, including at the very end. There's a whole kind of action sequence involving Big Ben that I really liked. I think I said earlier, it feels like a product, like a lot of Disney movies do. But I enjoyed what I was watching in the whole time. And then Charlie has been singing songs from it since we watched it, which to me is proof enough that the songs are not bad. Everyone keeps talking about how they're not catchy enough. There's probably not a supercalifragilistic in there, but that is okay. The songs are good. Movie's good. I like nice things.
What's your favorite song from the show?
I was saying that it was the bathtub song. Can you imagine that? Where they're kind of floating through the ocean, but the balloon song.
The Aquaman scene.
The balloon song at the very end is the one Charlie's been singing, so that's the one that's been kind of stuck in my head.
There's a big song in the middle.
Well, there's the light fantastic one that all the chimney sweeps do, or not the chimney sweeps.
Yeah, that song is maddening.
I'm not crazy about that song. Then there's the big one they do. The cover is not the book, and the
cover is not the cover. Yeah.
The
burlesque show.
Yeah, that's like not also the catchiest song, I don't think.
That's the most fun number.
It is definitely the most fun number, and it's the one that I think has the least relationship to the original. There's not really anything like that in the original movie, which I like Mary Poppins changes her entire personality and her accent and her hair to do this musical song.
Right. She does a show. She's like in a musical.
And Lin-Manuel Miranda raps, which apparently people got upset about. I mean, it's like mildest.
Rapping feels
imaginable.
Like.
It's vast overstatement. Yeah. Anyway, I liked it. Why don't you guys like nice things?
I don't know. Hearing you describe it makes me think that it's a charming movie that I should watch again.
If I didn't know how wrong you were, I would have nothing to say. Yeah.
Exactly. Why is this movie so dysfunctional? I will admit that I watched it on a screener. I did not see it on the big screen, trapped in a room
with
cheer.
I've seen it in both formats, and it is
wow,
equally flat. No matter where you see it.
I watched it over the course of 2 days because I watched it with a toddler. So, like, maximum unideal viewing circumstances.
I don't know why this movie can't muster any energy. And it made me question if the first Mary Poppins was good either. Now, I am a Bedknobs and Broomsticks boy, B-O-I. I love my Angela, who's in this movie, which means I really woke up at the end when Angela Lansbury appears in a role that probably was supposed to be for Julie Andrews, but throw the Bedknobs and Broomsticks lady a bone. I've always liked that movie because it had a big plot. There was war going on and magic, and the animated world was like a parallel universe. In Mary Poppins, it's never been my favorite movie, but I as you said, the songs are so jaunty and fun, and the animation is intoxicating, and I think Julie Andrews' presence is really magical. And I guess the way she's singing is so calibrated in that original movie that Spoonful of Sugar is a lesson, and we listen to every single word drip out of her mouth. I didn't have any of that pep in Mary Poppins Returns, and I think it's because it starts on such a dour note. As you said, there's a plot, and Ben Whishaw's Michael Banks, all grown up, is going to lose their house, and it's just so sad, and like Jane Banks is fighting a labor movement and trying to get that off the ground, and the kites are falling apart, and the skies are gloomy, and Lin-Manuel Miranda's just driving around on his bike. I don't know. I was not having any fun when I entered this universe, and I'm not sure that closer to the book's version of Mary Poppins that Emily Blunt pulls off, which is good, is a real entryway to whimsy and fun that the movie hopes to achieve.
I mean, I don't think you need her to be the one bringing the whimsy and fun, since there's so much else going on trying to throw things at you to be whimsical and fun. Like, no one is really as grouchy as the father was in the original, except for Colin Firth. He's not as big a part of it. And I guess she's closer to that. I haven't read the book, so I have no opinion on whether or not this is a truer Mary Poppins.
But, like, why – David, you are the expert here. Why is this movie not – no, I'll tell you what. This movie should feel like Paddington 2.
Sure.
This movie should bounce and be British and have this
it all feels like manufactured. There's no soul there. I mean, it's all completely plastic. It all feels like product. There is no actual attention to character or togetherness or growth. It's all just about this empty spectacle and this very forced optimism that feels – I mean, I'm sure for children plays, but I think the ending for me I was so mad at this movie that the idea that it just totally invalidates the entire – no, because the movie ends – I mean, like, whatever. Nobody's watching this movie for the plot. If you're – it's a photocopy of the original. If you're really that sensitive about it, then you can skip over this bit. But, you know, the end of the movie where everything is all fine and dandy. I mean, I know that's a surprise to anyone who thought they were all going to end up like in the gulag or something at the end of the movie. It's all because like, oh, surprise, we actually had a ton of money all along, and that's what solves our problems. It's not anything to do with like any sort of emotional drive of the characters, something that they learn about loving each other, the togetherness, the solidarity, and it's all just like, hey, guess what? Our financial problems were not ever real to begin with. We can move back into our huge fucking house and be fine. And therefore, blind optimism is last song in the movie. There's Nowhere to Go But Up, which is an apt if bold title to give the last song in your musical. feels like. You know, it's just like, just be happy. There's no real it's completely divorced from reality, and not in like a fun fantasy way where the main character is a talking bear, but in a this is bullshit corporate
just
pap.
Just a random example.
Right. No, I mean, like, I really was angry at this movie by the end of it. I do think that Emily Blunt is wonderful. It's hard to imagine anyone on Earth right now doing a better, updated version of Mary Poppins than she does. I think the songs range from, like, huh, to actively infuriating. Meryl Streep's whole scene should have just been cut from the movie. It's just one scene after another of, like, pseudo Lewis Carroll-like.
But that's what the original, that's what I don't understand. Why does the original function, and Katie, maybe you've seen it recently with Charlie, why does the original work? Why does it make sense? Because it's also esoteric and bouncing around and non sequitur stuff. They like go, those people who are floating on the, is that Mary Poppins or Bedknobs and Broomsticks?
No, they're
laughing.
The Meryl Streep sequence is I Love to Laugh.
Right.
Sequence, basically.
But that's just like, I don't even remember how that fits into the plot of the original
Mary
Poppins.
It doesn't. It's totally episodic and strung together, like you were saying. And I can't like claim to know that much about the tightness of the original Mary Poppins plot, since by watching it with a child, I have skipped just to the musical numbers a lot. So I don't really know how that works. I mean, I think that the power of the effects in 1964 had a lot more sway, and I don't think that's this movie's fault. I don't think that makes the moviegoers in 1964 stupider. I think effects are just different now when we look for different things in them. And it would be hard for the current Mary Poppins to kind of dazzle you in the same way.
I think that's worth just breaking out for 1 second and saying that our colleague Boga Biri wrote something for Vulture recently about will special effects still wow us? What do they need to do to really be surprising? Because we're so surrounded by CG and we've reached this maybe threshold in special effects where it's hard to do something new. And this movie is, as you said, chock full of special effects. When Mary Poppins arrives to the house, she does that bit where she's looking in the mirror and then she walks away and her reflection's still there and shoots her glance. Like, that's not a magic trick anymore. Like, 5-year-olds know what's going on when that happens. And going underwater as a la Aquaman is not that's too big,
how
right?
How maddening that the best scene in this movie, bar none, is the one that resurrects the old 2D style Disney animation.
Which Disney can't even handle. Disney did not do it themselves.
They had to outsource to 70 animators who don't work at the company. But it's like, this is so clearly the best thing going in this movie. It's your legacy, and you killed it. And like, you could bring it back if you so desired. But it just feels, it just felt like adding insult to injury for me, even though it was far and away the time I was happiest watching this movie. It was just like, you're also, by contrast, revealing the lifelessness of everything else here, because there's just so much energy and vitality and that sequence in the animation, in the characters who appear in like animal form.
Shout out to Chris O'Dowd as the dog footman.
Right. But like, even like Colin Firth's character appears as an animal in that sequence, and he's so much more engaging as a 2D animal than he is as a 3D Colin Firth. Although I did enjoy the face-off between the original Paddington, who was fired to make way for Ben Whishaw, love Colin Firth, but was probably never the right choice for that that character. I can't imagine how strange that would have been.
Want to say, David, before I get to push further, Paddington 2 is definitely better than Mary Poppins.
Thank you.
Like, it
thank
has
you.
Got ooh, the, like, ooh. British whimsy and heartfelt warmth of like a community and a neighborhood down.
Close call.
Like, it's just a tight movie. Like, Mary Poppins Returns, it's over 2 hours long. It is a Disney movie, so it is not tight. It's trying to throw everything at you possible and feels like it was written by 10 people.
It feels like for families that go to Walt Disney World every year, this that's what this movie is for, right? It's the same effect as like seeing the Mary Poppins show at Walt Disney World. It's new actors, it's almost the same songs, but it's there to like scratch this strange Disney itch that has emerged.
But it all
for some
feels
people.
Like you're at like Epcot Center. It all feels that soundstage feeling to it. Where all the actors are going to step off stage and like take off their oversized heads and like smoke behind the sets. I mean, like, it always
but that's
feels
what's that's
that
weird
way.
Too. I thought about this during the movie that this movie looks like fake in a soundstagey way, but the original Mary Poppins is all sound
stages.
Yeah,
I mean, the original,
you have that like
sound stage in LA, right? That wasn't even in London, and so that is.
But you have that you have that like cinemascopeness. You have that wideness in the, and we can go back to film quality and texture, but like it's such a different feeling for some reason.
It's just this movie. It felt like a really like hungover Sunday afternoon where it's gray outside and you're just sort of depressed and listless, but you're just gonna, you know. Suffer your way through it, because what else are you going to do? You're not going to get off the couch. That's like what this felt like.
I'm waiting for you to watch this movie 10 more times in those exact circumstances.
I don't think I could. I've now seen this movie twice, once in the theater, and then it was assigned to me to review. I didn't know I was going to be reviewing it when I saw it the first time, and I had forgotten everything that happened in the movie. And fortunately, the screener showed up at my door, and so I was able to watch it again. And I really struggled to get through it on my couch. So I don't foresee myself, not when Sphere is playing just a few channels away, do I foresee myself sitting through this movie. I just don't. Life's too short for Mary Poppins Returns. Try again next time, 54 years from now, and hopefully you luck into someone as talented as Emily Blunt to pick up the umbrella.
No, I'm so glad that Disney's really going to dazzle us with their ingenuity with the new Lion King.
No,
we'll be resurrecting Julianne.
Fire Rob
CGI.
Marshall. I mean, aim higher.
Mary Poppins 3.
Rob fucking Marshall. Jesus.
Oh, Tom Hooper's Cats is right around the corner.
Meow.
I'm done. To all our listeners out there, you win. Katie has driven me out of the entertainment space.
Musical adaptations are the new superhero movies for you.
I feel like we haven't talked about Tom Hooper's Cats enough.
I don't think we can talk about it yet because this is not on the podcast. I'm just anxious. I want to see the costumes. Do you think it's CGI or do you think it's costumes?
I assume it's costumes. I feel like CGI is not really Tom Hooper's bag.
Yeah, that would be weird. But how do you do the movie in a way that supports the costumes? That's what
I don't know.
In this like photorealism driven era, it just seems strange.
It's going to be so weird.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
Let's say you're lost in a park. Sure, you can give in to the dark, or you can trip a little like fantastic with me.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. As mentioned, we'll be back in the next 2 weeks with our top 10 episodes, so look forward to those. We've already recorded them. They are really great, as usual. Those are always really fun episodes to record. So look forward to that. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon.com, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them with friends, you can leave your comments on what we talked about, we'll read them. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich. You can find me on IndieWire talking to you about Welcome to Morrowind, if I got to wrap my head around that one by the embargo on Wednesday. And that Kenneth Branagh movie where he plays Shakespeare. He's cutting out the middleman, where he usually plays Shakespeare's characters, and he's just playing Shakespeare this time.
Good for you, Kenneth.
Yeah, our episode's going to be up before that embargo goes down on Thursday night, so I can't reveal my feelings here. You're going to have to read them on the internet. You can read all of our things on the internet, or just talk to us in general on Facebook, where, against, I think, all of our better judgment, we still have an account. It's Fighting in the War Room on Facebook.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com on that podcast, Little Gold Men, and on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where we love to hear from you. And you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Aquaman, what's your favorite aquatic movie that's
nautical?
Not
nautical movie, right?
Nautical movie, you're right. Yeah,
thanks,
nautical
thanks
movie.
For
aquatic.
Your question, Dave.
Yeah, same thing.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with our top 10 next week.
Well, just carry on until the dawn. It's darkest right before the light. A little light fantastic, won't you? Trip a little light fantastic, come on, trip a little light fantastic.